Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santaferadiocafe.org thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking with Gretchen Yost, veterinarian with the Española Valley Humane Society. I'm happy now to welcome to the program Camila Bustamante. She is Dean of Community Workforce Development at Northern New Mexico College, and she's here to talk about Sostenga, the third annual Garlic Harvest Festival in Española, which is coming up this Saturday, the 2nd of July. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you, Mary Charlotte. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, Garlic Harvest, Garlic Festival. It's only June. Are we already harvesting things?
Garlic comes up early. In fact, we always take our garlic out of the ground on the 4th of July weekend. It gets planted in November. So it sits in the ground doing its thing throughout the winter. And this year, because we had a very light snow, we didn't get the moisture we needed, and we had a very cold winter, we don't have as much garlic this year as we would have hoped, but it does always come up in July.
Now, does it need cold in order to flourish?
It does best. It is a bulb, so it is a root. So it does best like anything that you would plant in the winter and look forward to seeing it in spring or early summer. So it's
like
the
your
best.
Tulips, I guess.
Like your tulips, exactly.
So garlic is something that I associate with the Mediterranean, with Italian cooking and things like that. Does it have a long tradition here in New Mexico?
It came with the Spanish as well, and there are some varieties that I've heard and I haven't seen of native garlic that was here, and I'm not sure about any indigenous uses of those garlics, but it did come with the Spanish and is used heavily, as you know, in a lot of the traditional dishes. You can't have a good chili without its share of garlic.
So. Right. So what is happening on Saturday?
Saturday we have our harvest festival, and it starts at 6 o'clock in the morning, and that is because by 2 o'clock it is going to be too hot to even be standing outside.
6 in the morning?
6 in the morning.
6. And 0, 6.
6, 6, 6, 600. Yeah, it's
600
six
hours.
6 a.m., yes.
Do people really get up that early?
They do, and it's wonderful. It's sweet. It's the morning is crisp. I'm not sure how crisp. It's been very dry, but we'll still have a lovely, very early morning wake up together and watch we're right off of the Rio Grande, so the mist is coming over the trees, even in this particular season. So it's just going to be absolutely beautiful. It's an early, early morning. We have breakfast burritos, and people eat, and then the teams start getting together. And right now we have 4 teams, and we're really not looking for too many more teams this year just because we do have a lighter harvest than we have before. But so almost every team is guaranteed to win. We have cash prizes. They go out into the field and they pick as much garlic as they can, and the one that picks the most gets a first prize of $500. The second team gets a second prize of $200. And then third place is $100. And then there'll be a fourth team and they'll get a pat on the back and a certificate, a handshake.
Now, whose garlic is this?
This is the Sostenga Center for Sustainable Food, Agriculture, and Environment at Northern New Mexico College. And it's a student-run program, a student collaborative of a greenhouse, a farm that includes the garlic field. We have chili, we have tomatoes, we have other things that we grow. A small store, so we have a tiendita that is part of a commercial kitchen, and we're soon to open the coffee shop, both at the tiendita and at the library addition that's going in. But it's all in the interest of student experience in entrepreneur development, sustainable agriculture, soil improvement, environmental science, and ultimately marketing, having your final product. So it's very much a learning process.
What does the local garlic that is growing up there taste like compared to other garlic?
It really depends on the season. What we've been able to get from our local variety is a very strong, what we would refer to as a hot garlic. Tons of flavor. Not the largest, and frankly, a larger bulb carries less flavor. But
yeah, those really big bulbs, you can roast them, and they're quite mild. You can eat the whole clove. Hell, you can eat the whole head.
Absolutely. And the smaller ones, a clove in a good pot of a large pot will go a long way. So we have a medium-sized to smaller bulb that's very, very strong.
Let's talk more about sustainable agriculture and the fields that people are studying that you just mentioned at Northern New Mexico College.
You bet. First, I'll just say the premise in Rio Arriba County, and something that we all acknowledge once we really think about it, with regard to the availability of water, the original acequias systems, what the acequias systems meant to providing food along the Rio Grande, and a good Google Earth search and looking at that valley shows that it is all laid out in line with the law of the Indies, with the water structures.
Google Earth shows the acequias?
Not this, you won't, I guess if you zoomed in close enough, but you can absolutely see the way the land is parceled out. And it was in long strips rather than in squares because you did not plant on irritable, you do plant on irritable land. You don't build on irritable land. So the way it's laid out along the waterways, when you look at the long parcels, you'll notice that it goes from the acequia head to the Rio Grande, and that's why you have the long land the way it is, and it was broken up per family on these longer strips. That model has worked now for a few centuries, as we've acknowledged. It also allowed for the native peoples to no longer have to migrate up and down, but actually bring water into their lands where they were living. So it, cut down on a little bit of the migration from the cliffs into the fields and then back and forth. So it really brought that availability of water. And when we had the Great Depression in this country, we didn't have soup lines in northern New Mexico. It's one thing, and I'll say, a lot of people say, oh, yes, but we still were very poor. And I say, but we always ate well.
Right.
And we had a diverse diet. Legumes are a very important part of our diet and have always been. And now even the FDA and the public health people recognize that beans are very important to our diets. And it's one of those that we've been able to grow well all the way from the San Luis Valley into northern New Mexico. So it's really about just having a diversity of food and doing it right so that we don't deplete the quality of the soil, and being able to maintain and rotate crops so that the soil quality stays rich and viable, that we don't wear it out by a monocrop, which is something that on our small farm, even though we will always have the monocrop of garlic, we will have to be very conscious of how we nurture the soil and rotate the crop. So we're on a relatively large field at the college, and we plant different things at different times of year in order to maintain that soil quality. So it's really about assuring that those traditions of water use, soil improvement, are adhered to without using chemicals and things that will just deplete and kill the soil quality, as well as having a diversity of food products that actually enrich the system.
And, of course, legumes give back to the soil.
Absolutely, yeah. So each type of plant that we put into the ground actually takes and provides different nutrients for different purposes.
We're talking to Camila Bustamante about the third annual garlic harvest happening in Española. So this is very important work because of the reality of soil degradation in the United States and really all over the world. And it's actually, if you think about it and look at the scale of pollution, building on fertile land instead of using it for agriculture, using land for things like biofuels instead of food. I mean, you just look at the big picture, not to mention soil just washing into rivers and things like that. We're in trouble.
You bet. The chemicals, most of the chemicals and fertilizers that are used, and I would say almost and if I had to take a guess, and even in just discussions with the state agronomist, there's probably about 10% of our national population not using petrochemical-based chemicals in the soil. That petrochemical-based fertilizer actually kills any microbial life in that soil and really inhibits our ability. So when people think that they're actually providing nutrients, they're killing off the natural microbes necessary to ensure the fertility of that soil. It's really now a movement, and when I say about 10% of the total population, but the good news is with the organics movement, and I say there have been organics around for a while, but it's always seemed like it was this trendy, inaccessible thing to many, many people.
Well, there was organics in the whole entire history of civilization.
Absolutely, and that's the connection that we're trying to make. We're trying to say your tradition is exactly the sustainability. You didn't have to ever go to these chemical-based fertilizers.
Because they hadn't been invented.
They hadn't been invented, and you can do it the way your great-grandfather did. They were doing just fine.
And it's so it's something that people have always done here, and then those traditions have been challenged, and now people are embracing them again.
Absolutely, and it's time to do that.
Now, is the garlic harvest that you're talking about, is that watered solely through acequias?
Yes. We're on the Vigilis ditch, so we have water rights on campus, and it is watered through the acequias. Mm-hmm.
So tell us more about the other parts of it, the tiendita, the little store, the business, and the marketing. Are people learning to market garlic and garlic products?
They are. Our students are. I know that some of them might not be as in love with garlic as they thought they were to start because they're all garliced out. But the beauty is that we have...
But they're very healthy.
They're healthy, and they smell good. The thing that we do have with the tiendita, because we have a commercial kitchen. The commercial kitchen was put on campus by Johnson Controls Northern New Mexico, which was working to get a contract at Los Alamos National Laboratory. So in 1998, a commercial kitchen, because at that time, in an economic development analysis, it was revealed that the local food was a priority in the neighborhood, that people really wanted to find mechanisms for maintaining the food traditions and capability for marketing. So the value-added component, a commercial kitchen, was built at the college. That commercial kitchen has been subsidized by the college, and right now everyone will acknowledge that this state has been seeing, as well as the rest of the country, economic hard times. And instead of closing the commercial kitchen, the Sostenga Center is really established to support in a network system the ability to keep that kitchen open, because even at full capacity with 23 producers in a commercial kitchen, it doesn't really pay for all of the costs in maintaining and keeping a commercial kitchen. And that's important for anyone anywhere who says, let's have a commercial kitchen where people can make their own products. It's expensive. But with our tiendita, which is now the little storefront where people who make things in the kitchen can also sell their goods, and many of them sell at Whole Foods and other places, they can also sell in the storefront. So that money goes back to pay in. The coffee goes in to pay in to that. The lunches for students who come and eat goes to pay in. So the whole system starts to pay for itself. So it's a dynamic system. And then the food that's being grown in the field is part of our salad bar. We have bakers who come in, and that goes back into the system. And it's a self. The goal is to keep it and work it as a self-sustaining system.
Has it gotten there yet?
We're very fortunate right now. We're working with the support of an Economic Development Administration grant. It has not gotten there yet because it's only 2 years old right now. And we are adding the coffee shop components to it later this summer, I'm hoping, but we haven't received the coffee. We have been able to keep the doors of the kitchen open even before we got the grant reissued. So I would say we're limping along without the grant, but we're still walking. With the grant, we're able to make things a little easier and move forward on some of those processes that we know will be valuable, such as we know we have a lot of apples up north. We're going to get a pasteurizer and a juicer, and we'll have good Northern New Mexico apple cider apple juice available. So it'll be part of our system and a product that will have the Sostenga label. We do sell our garlic, and we did very well last year when the weather was different, but La Nina has created some new realities for us. So it's all a balance, and it's all a learning process. It is absolutely a learning laboratory for students and what it means to have something that can be sustainable as far as marketing and development of food.
And they're also learning about not only local weather patterns and soil and acequias and water and all those kinds of things, but what's happening in the Pacific Ocean is also affecting their harvests.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So this Saturday, the 2nd of July, Sostenga la Vida, third annual garlic harvest festival. For those of us who may not want to get up at 6 in the morning or at 5 in the morning to be there at 6 and pull garlic. Okay, what happens the rest of the day?
The day goes on until 2:30, and it's lovely. We have music. You can see, watch the people in the field picking the garlic, listen to wonderful local musicians. We're actually going to have a presentation by Tewa Women United on the Three Sisters. That would be the corn, the squash, and the bean, and how those symbiotically serve to provide the food and the nutrients necessary to have maintained a good, healthy culture in northern New Mexico for a long time. So we're really looking forward to that presentation. We have Cipriano Vigil playing. A lot of good local music, food. We have some presentations on the medicinal value of garlic. We will have a solar oven actually roasting garlic, which is always yummy to spread on some bread. And actually we'll have some homemade tortillas this year, which it just makes me nervous at the thought, but it sounds wonderful. But to have some fresh roasted garlic on homemade tortillas, pretty close to living.
Worth the price of admission all by itself.
All by itself, yes. It's going to be a wonderful event. And it's just a lovely place to sit and talk and listen to music and enjoy each other's company while watching the teams pull the garlic. So it's just fun.
And there's not even really a price of admission at all.
It's not. You just show up. It's $5 for the burrito, and we have a silent auction. So if people want to participate, if people want to just donate, then it is our, if you will, it is our show for the year. It is one of those to get people more informed about what we're doing in northern New Mexico, and we do appreciate any donation that we can get because we are a nonprofit. It is tax deductible. So if you want a breakfast burrito for your $5, or you can just donate $5, whatever you want, but it's an opportunity to just really enjoy the day.
And some of the proceeds will go to the Children's Juvenile Diabetes Research Fund?
Yes. In fact, we should be giving a check to them at the event this year, and that turns out to be sort of a business office question, where I'll just give them a symbol of the check, but this would be from last year's harvest, and we will celebrate that. It's about really healthy food, healthy people, healthy culture.
And if you eat the way you've just been talking about, which is locally grown food like beans and squash and garlic and tomatoes and all those kinds of things, you're a lot less likely to get any kind of diabetes.
You're a lot less likely to get any type of diabetes. Absolutely. The less processed the food, the better off we are, the less sugar. So it absolutely is a public health day.
Camila Bustamante is Dean of Community Workforce Development at Northern New Mexico College. And how can people find out more about the event if they want to check the website or give a call?
Yes, they can check the website. It is at sostengalavida.com, or they can call me at 747-5457. That's where they can get any more information that we'll be putting out there. We also have our sponsors listed at that site. We're very grateful to those who have contributed to this wonderful event, and I want to give a shout out to all of them. There's an extensive list, so I don't want to leave anybody out by starting to
okay.
do that.
Well, Camila, thanks so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much.
I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Gretchen Yost. She is a veterinarian with the Espanola Valley Humane Society. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having me.
So before we talk about anything else having to do with veterinary medicine and shelter medicine and things like that, let's talk for a moment about this fire that is going on. Los Alamos has a mandatory evacuation, and that has a tremendous impact on animal shelters in this area.
Absolutely. Have taken in about 96 animals. Most of them all came in after the mandatory evacuation was put in order. Folks coming down and checking into hotels or checking in with friends who unfortunately couldn't take their animals with them. So we decided early on and planned for it that we would try to get our animals, shelter animals, out into foster care and make room and make preparations for evacuees. We had no idea how many we'd actually have. There weren't actually that many for the Cerro Grande fire. But I don't think we as an organization put out the announcement that we would take animals at that time. This time we did, and so a little bit ambitious there, but it's all been very good, I think, for the animals, but ultimately for these poor people that have had to evacuate.
So when people evacuate, they leave their houses, and sometimes they go stay at a hotel that doesn't take animals, or they stay at friends' houses who, for whatever reason, can't take animals.
Exactly, allergies or too many animals already, or too many, you know, people, not enough room. So I'm just very thankful that the people brought their pets with them. I had the opportunity to go down to Katrina after that hurricane, and as you know, there were lots and lots and lots of pets that were forced to be left behind. They wouldn't, they were
that
not.
That was one of the greatest travesties of the United States emergency system ever, is that they would not take people who insisted on bringing their pets. You had to either let your pets die or die with your pets.
Absolutely. It was. And I remember a little old man that stayed in knee-deep water with his dog for 4 or 5 days, and his son forced him to evacuate in a boat, and but they would not let the dog come with them, and they were reunited weeks later, amazingly. But most animals were not reunited with their owners. I mean, they a lot of them got new homes, which was terrific, but
and a lot of them died that didn't have to die.
Absolutely.
So here we have people evacuating with their pets, and so the animals that you already had at the shelter, those are the ones that you've been trying to find foster homes for.
Absolutely. And we did this, we kind of had a dry run back in February when we had the freeze in northern Mexico, and we lost the gas in Española. And at the shelter, we lost not only heat but also water. And you can't really run a shelter like that. So within hours, we were able to mobilize our volunteers to come, and we cleared out the shelter in, like I said, a matter of hours. So this time, it's kind of double the effort, because not only do we have to get our animals out, but check the evacuees in. So luckily, it's all gone fairly smoothly, amazingly enough.
The animals that are being fostered out,
mm-hmm.
those are also, if somebody who's fostering them falls in love with them, do they get to adopt them?
Absolutely. Yes. There's applications, adoption applications, but there's also foster applications too. So anybody that we would foster to would be a wonderful home, for an adoption. So we actually call that failed fostering, because and I'm guilty of it myself, of adopting a foster. But ultimately, finding homes for these guys is what we're all about. So we'll definitely take that.
So we will see what happens, and we'll get updates in the coming days as this fire progresses, or maybe with some luck it'll rain, or who knows what'll happen.
Yeah, absolutely. It's kind of open-ended. We are prepared if we had to evacuate to evacuate all these animals with us elsewhere. So you always have to kind of keep that in mind too. But hopefully that won't come to that.
So the Santa Fe Animal Shelter, I mean, you guys are full at this point. I think Santa Fe is still accepting animals that need foster homes, or that need a place to basically a place to crash for a while.
They sure are, and we've been very impressed by the number of calls we've got from Albuquerque veterinary clinics, local veterinary clinics, and all kinds of people and organizations that say, let us know if you need any help, if you need any place to put animals, and so once again, we're blessed and pleased with the positive part of this tragedy. So,
what can people do who are listening, who want to either donate their homes or donate stuff? What does the Espanol shelter need at this point?
Well, thanks for asking. Right now, we can always use volunteers. Call the shelter first, depending on what the situation is. It might be walking some dogs. It might be cleaning. Obviously, there's a lot of cleaning to do when you've got so many animals that you're feeding and caring for every day. We are asking for cat litter, the non-clumping kind. And we can always use food and dry food, puppy food, cat food. Dog food. Yeah.
Have most of the animals that have come in been dogs, cats, equal amount of both, anything else?
Mostly dogs, I'd have to say, but I have been surprised at the number of cats that have also come in. And we did actually get two birds. And there was a bird rescue that contacted us and said that they'd be willing to take those birds because birds can be stressed, and so it's better for the birds to be in a low stress environment. So that's where they are now.
I would think birds would be stressed if there were cats and dogs around.
Absolutely. Well, we kind of had them separate, but still, it's controlled chaos there. So it's good to get the birds out.
We're talking to Gretchen Yost from the Espanola Valley Humane Society. So let's talk for a moment about shelter medicine. You are a veterinarian at an animal shelter. That's something that we haven't really talked about much on this show. There's a lot of veterinarians in private practice, I suppose, but you're a shelter vet. Is that a whole career path for people?
It sure is. And it used to be, I think, even when I was in vet school, and that was graduated 11 years ago, it seemed to be the place where you thought about retiring. Nobody actually thought about going as a new veterinarian into shelter medicine, and that's really turned around. And now there are specialty programs, certain classes that you can take in vet school, and renewed respect for the field, and a lot more science that's going behind it, and trying to do this well in terms of taking care of large volumes of animals in a stressed situation. And so vaccination protocols, how do you house them properly, how do you lower stress environmentally, it all plays a part in animal health. And ultimately, you keep the animals as healthy as possible, and then you can find homes for them better. Yeah.
What are some of the differences between a regular veterinary clinic and being a veterinarian at a shelter?
Being a small animal veterinarian in private practice, and I did that for about 7 years in a clinic in Espanola, it's a very hands-on with a single animal and then the client. I mean, there's a client-patient animal relationship that you have with every single interaction. And there's always, there's lots of diagnostics, and you have to depend upon the owner and their finances a lot to determine, how far you can go diagnostically with an animal. But, ultimately you have more resources because you're dealing with an owner. In shelter medicine, you're dealing with a lot of animals, and a lot of these animals they don't come in the best of health. There's nobody that can tell you a history about them. Typically, most of our animals are strays, or they're dropped in our drop box, so often I wish I had a medical history, but we don't have that luxury. And certainly, it's always, finances are going to be always an issue in the shelter environment, because there's just not enough money to do all those high diagnostics. And so you have to be more reliant upon, upon things like your stethoscope and a microscope. And it's a different world. But, I love it because these are the absolute most helpless and hopeless, not really, but needy animals that there are. I mean, there's not anybody advocating for them, so I feel very, very fortunate to be in a place that I get to advocate for them.
It sounds sort of like being a doctor in a third world clinic or something like that.
I always say when I'm trying to describe this that it's kind of like the Peace Corps of veterinary medicine, up there in Espanola. We're faced with a lot of challenges, and I kind of sought that out as a veterinarian, so that's why I kind of ended up in private practice there too. Not so different from the shelter, dealing with a poor community. They're not able to do as much for their animals, and so you are relying on the amazing strength of actually the body and the healing, to pull animals through.
When you are working at a clinic that's really outfitted and has the latest and greatest stuff, what is some of the latest and greatest stuff in terms of diagnostics and treatment?
Wow. It's been a while since I've been in one of those places, but absolutely, and I'm very, very glad that these practices are out there, and my colleagues are out there that specialize. But you can literally do for an animal most anything you could do for a person. I mean, there are specialists in everything from ophthalmology to cancer to neurology.
They don't give them cataract operations.
Absolutely.
They do?
Yes, ma'am. Yeah, that's old news.
Really?
Yeah, it is. And don't, no, I was going to give you a price per eye, but that's long ago, so
right,
I don't,
right.
Yeah. But absolutely, absolutely.
And they have defibrillators and all the cardiac stuff for animals?
Sure. You can, there's, very standard to have echocardiograms done on your animals to diagnose murmurs and things like that. And then depending upon the condition, and, it's amazing, but animal physiology is almost exactly like humans. I mean, they just have hair and tails, but everything that can happen to us can happen to them, in terms of cardiac issues that might, well, actually they don't get the sclerosis, and so they don't need bypass surgeries, but I guess they eat better than we do.
We're talking to veterinarian Gretchen Yost. So it does actually bring up for me a kind of question about whether animals should get the same level of medical care that human beings get in a society where human beings don't get sufficient medical care.
Mm. Well, I'm often told by folks that that sometimes they wish that their veterinarian was their doctor.
I feel exactly that way.
And not so much because, there's that we don't do as much, but I think we, as veterinarians, and the way veterinary medicine is structured in this country, is that you do have that general practitioner that you go to, and we look at the whole animal. We look at the eyes and the feet and the heart, and we touch the animal because you have to. You have to have physical contact with the animal, to diagnose it, because you're not able to talk to them, so I think, because of that, you get a more global picture of a medicine of an individual. And sometimes I know I feel like human medicine is they're just focused on their organ system, and they don't see everything. And I apologize to any EMDs are out there. They're under the gun, doing a lot of great stuff. But
right.
So
it's really, without calling itself that, it's just by definition a kind of holistic medicine.
I absolutely think so. It's very hands-on, and of course I'm glad that there are specialists out there that you can, as a general practitioner, go ahead and get that cataract surgery done. You wouldn't want me doing that, absolutely. But for somebody who wants that done, it's there, and it's safe, and it's available, and I think people are demanding that,
What are the kinds of medicine or the kinds of procedures that you most frequently do in an animal shelter?
Well, that's easy. Spay neuter. It's all about spay neuter.
Ah, yes.
And so that's kind of one of the things that, as a, that's why shelter medicine was thought, well, you want to retire there because you don't want to deal with people anymore. Maybe you can sit in the back room and you can do lots of spays and neuters and not deal with quote-unquote hard medicine. That's not what I think, even though I do lots of spay neuters, and you become kind of an expert at that, and it's your niche, and you can do a lot more, and you can do them very safe, which is what we do to hopefully prevent the numbers, of animals coming in that we have to find homes for. But, every once in a while, and, well, not too infrequently, animals will come in with lacerations or wounds or things that you need to, to do surgery on. I've done a few amputations, and some intestinal surgery, some things that, and eye, taking out eyes, if they have to, which is not my favorite thing to do, but when it has to be done. So we, yes, we specialize in spay-neuter, but if a shelter animal is adoptable and needs something else and we're able to do it with our equipment there, we'll do it. And if it's the difference between doing it and not doing it, and that animal doesn't have a chance at a home.
To what extent do you engage in education in the community so that the kind of problems that are coming in won't happen as often?
Not enough. I wish we had unlimited funds to do that, to make that even a bigger part of our program at the Humane Society. I'd like to, it'd be great to get out to all the schools and every kid in every classroom, and because I think that there's a lot to be gained by talking and showing the human-animal bond and reconnecting, you know, with kids and animals, because they're the ones that are going to change things in the future. But you know, we do some of that, absolutely, but you know, always looking for help to do more.
So ideally, with more funding, you'd have more education programs and get out into all the schools and all of that.
Absolutely, yeah. We do have a few, great volunteers that are teachers as well. So you know, some of them bring their classes to the shelter and they volunteer and they really do work, and they do little fundraisers to raise funds for the shelter, and there's a nice connection there. So any teacher out there that wants to kind of have that partnership, please let us know. We'd love to have that.
Now, you actually ended up adopting a dog who had quite a dramatic story.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
Jack. He's our famous dog now.
Yeah.
Wow.
He's been in the paper, everything.
Absolutely. And people from coast to coast seems like have heard about Jack. Jack came in and, I think he's older than the hills. Probably close to 13, 14, 15. And he's a heeler. Very gray in the face, one floppy ear down, one up, he came in with, describe this without being too grisly, but his right arm was essentially dead and mostly bone, and it had been that way a long time, very infected, and it needed an emergency amputation. The person that brought it in, said at first he'd had him for 6 weeks and then said no. So investigation is pending on that. It happened to be actually a police officer, which made us kind of crazy. So
because there was a suspicion that the dog had been abused or neglected.
Well, definitely neglected. If indeed this dog, Jack, was with this person for 6 weeks with his arm in such shape, I can't. It's just unconscionable that you don't do something about it. Even if it's I can't do anything, please,
please
let
help.
Him go. Yeah. Or yes, absolutely. Even if you don't have the money, and that's what we absolutely want people to come to us, and we will try. I mean, I can't say that we will. We'll be able to have the resources to fix every animal or whatever, at least they have a chance and they don't have to suffer, and we'll relieve their pain and perhaps get them to a place where they can actually have a home. But don't let them suffer out there. And the fact that he was a police officer just kind of elevated the thought that do you even realize that this is severe neglect, And so we did push the issue, and there is a case pending for neglect and cruelty. In the meantime, Jack was a real trooper. We amputated the leg the next day, he was severely sick, and so I took him home for recuperation, all the while thinking that I'm just going to get him well, and then we'll find him a wonderful home. And his story got out there and touched so many people. We had lots of donations from far and wide, $5 here, $25 there. It was very touching, and certainly enough to take care of him and many others, actually, that don't get so famous, long story long, he's much better. And I thought I could let him go, but I just couldn't. So
another failed,
a failed foster.
Foster,
absolutely. So I'm actually a little feel a little guilty about that, but.
But Jack is a happy dog.
He's a happy dog. Yep. And certainly one of our many, many success stories. So so maybe through his plight, we get donations so that we can help other animals medically. But maybe there's some folks, locally that are kind of rethinking the whole animal cruelty neglect thing, and that, we're going to take this seriously, and maybe this will or won't have any legal implications, but we're not just going to look the other way.
There's so much to be said about the phenomenon of compassion, whether it be for other human beings or whether it be for other animals, noticing the suffering of others and doing what you can to alleviate it. And you can't save everybody, and everybody knows that, but when it's right in front of you, there's something you can do.
Absolutely, and you need to recognize it. So I fear that some are a little numb to this, and you would hope that it wouldn't be your law enforcement, because whether it's a dog or whether it's a child or an old person, all the innocent and maybe the ones that can't quite tell us exactly where they hurt or why they hurt or who hurt them. They're all kind of in one boat, and we need to recognize and be empathetic to all creatures. So.
We're talking to veterinarian Gretchen Yost. Now, how are we doing in northern New Mexico in the areas that you see in terms of education on the importance of spaying and neutering one's animals? Mm. I know that we've talked about this on the show a number of times, that Colorado's spay-neuter programs have been so successful that they have to import puppies from New Mexico. But we seem to still have an overabundance of unwanted animals because of people not spaying and neutering their pets.
Sure. And, I would say there's much, much, much more work to be done. There's certainly, we do, in Española, we, at our clinic, 15 to 20 a day. And you would think, and that's up to a little over 3,000 a year. They do many here in Santa Fe at the spay-neuter clinic. And, of course, private veterinarians are doing it all the time, too. You would think that would make, that would be all you would need. But the reproductive rate is so high that it just seems like we're having a hard time keeping up with everything. There's certainly, in a given day, there's certainly animals that I spay or neuter that, I'm thinking, I think that the owner probably would have done that anyway, or these animals are probably in a house and they probably wouldn't have had puppies. But there are some that come in and you go, I'm so glad I am spaying this one that's probably had 5 litters already and probably going to have 5 more, and if I didn't do this. So I think it's challenging in our world to find those animals and to get into those communities or find. Those are the ones that you need to get out there and spay and neuter. And they call that now, the buzzword is targeted spay neuter. That's going to be our challenge moving forward, is maybe analyzing more of our intake where are these animals coming from? Who are they coming from? And getting out into those communities and going door to door, or going out there and bringing the animals to the shelter for spay neuter. Of course, when you're looking at that, the cost per spay or neuter just climbs, So
of course, yeah. Now you started out, veterinary medicine is your second career. You started out as an electrical engineer. How did you switch over to this whole new life of becoming a veterinarian?
I was very lucky. I could follow my dream. I had always thought about being a veterinarian, being a little girl, and I think a lot of little girls go through that phase anyway. And then I took a trip to Auburn Vet School, and I saw heartworms in a jar, or something that really kind of wigged me out a little bit. And also, I used to, and I still do, cry at every single animal movie. Do not ask me to go to any animal movie. So everybody in my family said, you can't be a veterinarian. You can't. So So I said, oh, okay, you know, I'll go over here and do this math and science thing that I like. And it was a good career, but I found that I was writing all my checks, you know, to the animal organizations, and I thought, well, why not get into the game? You know, I'm able to, and so so I decided to go down that road and take night classes and then apply to vet school, and was lucky enough to get in, lucky enough to have some life savings that I could plunk down into a 4-year vet school, and
It's harder to get into, I've heard, vet school than medical school.
I think we veterinarians tell you that. I don't know. it makes us seem smart. I don't know about that. I know that there's fewer vet schools. There's only like 28 vet schools
right.
in the country. So, but I don't know if
that may be part of it.
Yeah.
Is that there's just so many people who want to go to vet school. Did you meet other people who were doing second careers like you?
A few, sure. One of my best friends, she was a paramedic before and decided to go back. So we were kind of the older girl sat in the back row and the mother hens, I suppose, of the class. So
what is the greatest reward for you of being a shelter veterinarian?
I just, you know, as tired as I am at the end of every day, and that's physically and emotionally, I suppose, I feel really, really lucky that I actually have a job I care about. And I just don't think that a lot of people have that luxury of caring about it, about what they do. Every little life that I can touch and make better makes me better, makes me a better person, I think. And so, was that the question? I don't know. I kind of got off into my teary stuff. So
no, but I mean, if you cry at animal movies, do you cry when you does it hurt you when you lose an animal that you're caring for?
Sure. Absolutely. I you do kind of become a little bit, and you have to kind of philosophical about end of life. And I think, you know, on a personal level, that's helped me with you know, losses in my life. My father passed away last year, and I think I've been able to handle that better because I'm around the circle of life so much, and I realize, and in my own head, I think, I just know I'm going to see all these guys again, you know, and I kind of picture when I kind of cross that rainbow bridge that all these little fluffy things are going to just come and just pounce on me. And I certainly hope it's that way anyway. So it makes
me... In the
me
sky where there is no animal shelter and they're all free.
Exactly. And they're all healthy and they're all, free of everything, you know. It's all good. So
once again, if people want to get in touch with the Española Valley Humane Society and make any donations of time, money, food, or anything else during this fire season, what should they do?
Absolutely. Give us a call at the shelter. 753-8662 is our number. And we've got, if you're interested in fostering, you know, they'll connect you to our foster coordinator, volunteer coordinator. If you're interested in volunteering, we can give you the latest thing that we might have run out of, paper towels or cat litter. If you are at the store and want to buy something. And of course, monetary donations of any amount are always welcome. It's always tough. It's a tough environment.
Gretchen Yost is veterinarian at the Española Valley Humane Society. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. Thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.